Oh, Seth, did you start a fire?
Yeah.
Holy smokes, it's 85 degrees outside.
This is no joke, but my son wanted to start a fire last night, and I was like, it's 60 degrees out.
Yeah, that's chilly.
He's so used to the warm heat that's been happening. You got this all this warmer weather, and he wanted to start a fire because it's 60 degrees out. I was like, no, please don't. I want to actually sleep comfortably tonight.
Yeah. I don't know. Let's do something simple today. Something, I don't know, Marlon Brando or Elvis Presley. What's that? Well, how about the last 24 hours of Elvis Presley?
How about that? My grandmother, she was alive. She'd appreciate this.
I didn't really like him, you know. I didn't. I mean, he could sing. There's no doubt. I didn't like all his songs, but he had some pretty nice ones.
Yeah.
His
movies were just cheesy.
No offense if you're a big Elvis fan for his acting, but man, he was
that was goofy.
They were cheesy movies.
even when I was little, they were cheesy. But you know, I never really paid attention to him much at all. He just jiggled around too much.
There you go.
For me, I say, what the heck?
That's what the women liked, man. They liked that jiggling.
Well, he started back in the '50s. Yeah, 54, I think, was his first record.
And then that lip thing he did that made women swoon.
Boy. And I'll tell you, when I went in the Army, there was a lot of guys that really liked him. Holy catfish. I couldn't believe it. You should be listening to Jefferson Airplane, not Elvis Presley. Holy cow. I don't know. But I think that'd be a good, history lesson. It'd be interesting to see what he did and how he lived and the people around him and everything. Because they're the ones that drove him nuts.
His manager
Colonel
was stealing
something
from
or other, yeah. Colonel Parker or yeah, yeah. General Parker or something. He was a gambling nut. He lost $1.5 million in one night.
Yep. But there's two things with that manager. He was first off stealing a lot of money from Elvis, but the second thing was he was marketing I hate Elvis buttons and I love Elvis buttons at the same time. He was selling them both.
Plus, he was pushing them. He was pushing them really hard to do three shows a day.
Right.
All this kind of stuff. I mean, he really, 7 days a week.
And then he supported his drug use that kept him numb and dumb, you know?
Boy. Yeah, he just had a crew of people. He didn't like people that much, really.
Right.
He just kept his own crew around him and kind of wanted to control everything. But it's interesting, and I don't know. There's a whole different
you think about
surrounding
it.
Elvis
was really the first big pop star, if you really think about it. There were some other famous people beforehand, but Elvis was the first real internationally pops person.
Yeah.
Everybody else has followed suit, you know.
Yeah.
So he was country, rock, you know, pop. Whatever. He was everything almost.
And the way he lived, it was really two extremes. I mean, just unbelievable parties and stuff. Well, I think they talk about all this.
Yeah.
I listened to this a while ago, and it was kind of interesting, and it was just amazing. And I don't know. The guy died. He's kind of like Stalin, you know. He just died all by himself.
Cardiac arrest. Yeah,
I think he fell off the toilet.
And his daughter died not on the toilet, but she had a cardiac arrest too. He was only 42 when he died, and she was like 53 or 54, so 10 years difference.
Yeah,
well,
she lasted a little longer than him.
That's still rough.
That's the modern medicine.
Yeah, I know, right?
Jeez.
Maybe the drugs are better. I don't know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I don't know. Let's just do that, and then. Because it starts off with one of my favorite songs, and it ends with one of my favorite songs, too. So
right.
It's kind of a neat history lesson, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Let's call that a day.
Yeah.
Okay. See ya.
Touchdown in the land of the dead. Memphis, Tennessee, the home of the late, great Elvis Presley.
W.C. Handy, won't you look down over me? Yeah, I got a first-class ticket, but I'm as blue as a boy can be. Then I'm walking in Memphis, just walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis.
Here, for the first time, Elvis's closest friends and confidants, known as the Memphis Mafia, tell their own emotional story of Elvis's last few hours on Earth.
I turned him over. And I knew it was death. I just knew it.
Needless to say, a lot of times I've listened to an Elvis song and it just broke down, you know, and cried.
Elvis took drugs because he liked them. Everybody thinks of trying to escape anything. He just fucking loved them.
And I get pissed off at the people that helped contribute to it, but I get pissed off at Elvis. He was a smart man, he knew what he was doing, but he denied it.
I threatened the doctor. I said, if I ever see this man in this shape again, I will go all the way.
Colonel Parker walks up to me, we stand toe to toe, and he stares coldly into my eyes. He says, the only thing that's important is that that man is on stage tonight. Nothing else matters. Nothing.
Sun Studios in Memphis. It was here 50 years ago that rock and roll was born. And so began the legend that is Elvis Presley. In the course of a glorious career, Elvis would take the world by storm, starting in 1954 with his first hit, That's All Right, Mama.
I'm leaving town, baby. I'm leaving town for sure. Well, then you won't be bothered with me hanging around your door, but that's all right. That's all right, mama.
Elvis was a very, very shy, retiring type individual. He didn't like to be around new people. He didn't trust them. He trusted us. We were a source of comfort. He could be what he wanted to be around us. He could be himself. If there was an Elvis himself, and it was around us. Elvis did not make friends easy. He just didn't like to do it. And with us, he didn't have to do it. And with us, we all could be what we wanted to be, and he could be the same.
3 p.m. Thursday, the 15th of August, 1977. Elvis is preparing for yet another back-breaking tour, the second tour of that year. Elvis's girlfriend, Ginger Alden, didn't want to go on tour with him. Ginger was just 21 and not prepared to bow to his every demand. Something Elvis was used to, even during his doomed marriage to Priscilla. I'd be lost without your love. Over the years, his Memphis mafia had supplied him with a string of compliant girls.
If you've got wealth and looks, they're really going to come. And they're going to come fast and hard. And what you have to do is on a continual basis weed them out. Because you got to weed the squirrels out from the lambs, and the squirrels cause you more trouble than a lamb ever caused you. Not because they eat a lot of nuts, but it's because they're crazy, and this is the problem.
He was so charismatic that he would draw, you know, he was like, they were like moths flying around a flame.
The girl of my best friend.
It's funny to me today because just for the hell of it, one Saturday night at a time when there was only seven of us, including Elvis. See, on Friday night and Saturday night, Elvis used to let all the girls in that hung around the gates. And one Saturday night, just for the hell of it, I was bored. So I went around the house and I counted all the women that were in the house with us seven guys. And this is not an exaggeration. There was 152 women there.
Man, I thought I was in heaven. You know, what can I say? It was exciting all the time, you know. And I thought, man, you know, if this is a dream, I don't ever want to wake up, you know. So, but it had its moments too. But you know, overall, if you look at it, it was such an exciting time. It was something new. Elvis was gifted with. The fact that, you know, he was constantly looking for something new to do. And you never knew what this man was going to come up with, you know.
The phenomenal part of it was that the screaming and the hollering, and you couldn't hear. They wouldn't stop. And it would, he could sing a number, nobody even knew what he said. It was just pandemonium. It never stopped.
Elvis had a tremendous draw to him emotionally and physically, where you looked at him and you thought, that is probably about the best looking man I've ever seen, you know? And he just had a charisma about him. He had a way of pulling you in. People call it Southern charm. He had it in spades.
8 p.m., Thursday, the 15th of August, 1977. Elvis goes to the dentist in search of prescription drugs. He's accompanied by Ginger, Billy Smith, and Billy's wife, Jo.
In the movie years, the drugs were in control. The sleeping pills and the uppers for the energy level. I couldn't take them every day. Not to be the goody-goody, but I just couldn't take that pill because I knew what it was going to do to me. Make my mouth dry, it was just going to make me wired all day, and I just didn't want to do it. But I had to take them sometimes because he would stay up to 3 o'clock in the morning, 2:30, 3 o'clock, and we get up at 5 to go on location, and there's no way, and you don't. I learned from the very start, I sleep when he sleeps.
Fire! On the way!
The guys around Elvis, we were just, you know, we stayed wired up all the time.
We didn't go to bed till, you know, 2 o'clock in the evening, and it was tiring after a while, and so we'd take a little speed to stay up the next day, and a lot of times we couldn't go to sleep because we were high, and we had to take a sleep pill to go to sleep. And we lived that way for a long time. We really lived hard, but luckily we were young, we could do it.
Amidst the fun and games, there were already warnings of what excessive drug use would bring.
One time, I forget, we were going so hard that Elvis started getting a bloody nose. And we went to the doctor, and the doctor said, you guys need to get some rest. His resistance was getting down, and he kept getting a bloody nose, so we had to rest for a couple of days.
Elvis did everything to excess. He had massive appetites for food, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. He approached his search for spiritual serenity in the same enthusiastic way. Larry Geller was Elvis's personal hairdresser and spiritual guru.
Elvis had a beautiful head of hair. I mean, the man had everything. He even had the hair. It was a little fine. It lacked body, but he had a beautiful head of hair. And I remember I sprayed it, and I was molding it. And I said, so what do you think, Elvis? And he said, oh, great, great, great. And he swirled around in his chair. He looked and said, but I want to ask you a question. My hair is great, but what's more important to me is this. What are you really into, Larry? What are you really all about? It really threw me for a loss for a moment. I mean, here's a person who was totally straightforward. And I said, Elvis, I mean, you know that I work with celebrities and I do their hair. This is what I do for a living. But what's more important to me than anything else is my search for truth, to find the purpose for living. I said, look, I know you're Elvis Presley. You're the biggest star in the world. I know this must sound corny to you. He said, wait a minute, Larry. That's not corny at all. You have no idea how I need to hear what you have to say about this. Please, man, just keep on talking. And I did. The Self-Realization Park, which is close to the ocean in Southern California, in the Pacific Palisades, was a place that Elvis loved to visit. And the monks that lived there became friends with Elvis. And Elvis would love to just leave the world, walk around the park, enjoy the serenity. And people left him alone. They recognized him, because a lot of people do go there. It's a very special place. Nobody bothers anyone. Elvis would go into the chapel and he would meditate. We would go in the back and speak with some of the monks. They would reveal and explain certain experiences that they would have. We'd walk around the lake. Elvis loved the park. He said, look, how come I haven't an experience? I want to feel God. I said, well, Elvis, look, it doesn't happen like that. When you want something, you want it now and you expect it. You have to be patient and you have to surrender your ego.
How
In his latter years, Elvis embarked on a punishing touring schedule, organized by his manager, Colonel Tom Parker.
He didn't like the idea of doing, you know, two shows a night, sometimes three, 7 days a week, and it bothered him. And it festered and festered and festered. It's like when I called him from L.A. when we were going to do that last tour, and I said, you just need to shut it down. I said, fuck the tour. I said, cut it off. Let's just, you know, I said, let's just cancel this tour out. And he said, Lamar, I've got a payroll. Which, you know, when you say that, you go, well, he's right. But at the same time, I told him, I said, listen, I said, you got two or three guys around here that'll go to Hawaii with you. And I said, we'll hang out and you just, you know, and you can get yourself back together again. He said, let's talk about that after this tour's over. It sounds like a good idea. He didn't make it.
With his records no longer selling, Elvis's only income came from these tours. And being 40 plus, he no longer had a huge following. He was teetering on the brink of financial meltdown. Touring paid the bills for now, but 50% of the income went to Tom Parker. The Colonel, too, was facing bankruptcy.
Colonel Parker probably was one of the most degenerate gamblers I've ever known in my life. In Nevada, they used to say his money's not worth anything. He played roulette and would put chips on every number. He would play craps and bet the horn, the center. One night I was up about, God, I think I was up $50,000, $60,000. Remember, I was running the crap table crazy, and he came up and took my money and put it on Don't Pass. No, on Pass.
Yeah.
No, on Don't Pass.
You threw a seven.
And I threw a seven and lost it all. One pop. And I wanted to throw up, but I couldn't. And I said, you know, Jesus God, I said, I've worked my butt off here. He said, how much did you start off with? I said, I started off with $2,000. So he counted out $2,000 and gave it to me. He said, now you're even. And I'm like, God. But I mean, he was right. I was even.
Colonel gambled in a way.
I only lost $2,000.
You know, we all have our little idiosyncrasies.
That was his.
And his was gambling. And I loved him to death, but he didn't play the game like you have to play it to win. I mean, he would go through with those on roulette, and he would drop five or six chips there, two on that one, 10 or 12 on this one, and whatever fell out of his hand,
yeah.
That's what he'd do. And when he hit, yeah. He didn't really win, because he had more bet than what it would pay.
But he thought
off.
He did.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, one night in between shows, this was in 70, and we were at the crap table. And he called me and said, listen, he said, you got to stay with me here. And I said, well, I said, you know, I said, I've got to go upstairs early. He said, no, you stay here. He said, I'll get you up there on time. And I said, okay. So in a period of an hour and a half, he lost over $1.25 million.
Come on back and let's play a little house so we can do what we did before. Now we better come back, baby. Come.
One night, I walked down to the casino. I just left Elvis. This is after his show. And I noticed there was a large group of people roped off, and they were all in front of a table watching someone gamble. And as I walked up, it was Colonel Parker by himself at the table with stacks of chips. And he was playing the sucker's game of all games. It was called the Wheel of Fortune. And the odds of winning that game are the worst. It's better if you play craps or blackjack. At any rate, he's at the table, and he spots me in the crowd. Larry, he said, come on, come here, sit next to me. He said, I'm not doing too well. I need some luck. Give me some good thoughts, Larry. I said, okay, Colonel, and I felt so uncomfortable. I really did. After about 5-10 minutes, I said, Colonel, maybe you'll do better now. I hope you will, but I have to get back upstairs because Elvis needs me. I told him I was just going to walk down for a few minutes. So I left. The colonel was there for hours upon hours upon hours until like 5 o'clock in the morning, and he lost $1.5 million that night.
As Elvis prepared for his last tour that would start in Portland, Maine on August the 17th, it was clear that he had no choice but to perform if he were to remain solvent. And for Tom Parker, it was essential that his gambling losses were covered. Elvis had turned into the Colonel's own cash cow.
We were on tour in Louisville, Kentucky. And this was about 4 months before Elvis passed away. And Elvis, the night before, had a very difficult time. He felt he had a fever. He felt nauseous. He felt flu-like. He couldn't sleep. He had a very, very difficult night. It was late afternoon, and Dr. Nick was Elvis's doctor, who traveled with us, was in the bedroom with Elvis. I was in the front room. The television was on, and there was a pounding on the door, which was very unusual because we owned that floor. No one was allowed there. We had security cops positioned in front of the elevators. Everything was blocked off. So who would knock on the door like that? So I immediately walked over to the door, looked through the peephole, and there's Colonel Parker, who never came to visit Elvis on tour. I opened the door. I said, "Colonel." He said, "Where is he?" I said, "Well, he's in the bedroom. Let me tell him you're here." He said, "No, I'm going right in." So he, with his cane, he walked past me. He opened the door, and this is what I saw. Dr. Nick was holding Elvis's head. Elvis is in the bed, semi-conscious, almost comatose. And he was moaning. He was in such bad shape. And Dr. Nick was dunking Elvis's head into a bucket of ice water to revive him. The door closed. And I thought immediately, okay, this is good. This is good. Now the old man, Parker, is going to see what's going on here. He's going to see how bad, the bad shape Elvis is in. And he's going to do something about it. I mean, he can't allow this to go on. It's inhuman. 90 seconds later, the door opened up. Colonel Parker walks up to me and stands toe, and I get up. We stand toe to toe, and he stares coldly into my eyes. He says, "Now you listen to me. The only thing that's important is that that man is on stage tonight. Nothing else matters. Nothing."
There's a lot of them. I can't think of any right offhand.
I like to live up to my reputation of being a nice guy. This is it, folks. Beautiful, baby.
While committed to a hectic touring schedule at the behest of the Colonel, and with mounting financial and physical problems, Elvis and his mafia had become more and more isolated from the real world.
Well, I knew over the years Elvis was very isolated from the outside world. We didn't know what was going on the outside. We very seldom read the paper. We watched a lot of sports, a lot of TV shows. We didn't hardly watch the news. We were very, very much hidden from everything going on the outside.
We lived in an insulated world within our own group. And our group, I mean, somebody said that Elvis really never left his bedroom. Well, he didn't. Elvis would get on his airplane bedroom and go to a hotel bedroom and would go from a hotel bedroom to his Grayson bedroom.
Elvis, over the years, every once in a while, he'd get like that. He'd go to his upstairs and he might spend, well, a week or two and not even show his face. But that was only like a week or two. Now we're talking about months, you know.
10 p.m., August the 15th, 1977. The guys were assembling in Memphis for what would prove to be one tour too far. By the mid-70s, Elvis's drug habit had become a serious threat to his life.
In 1975, what I had been seeing a little bit of the previous year or so was getting worse, and I was very concerned about his health. It wasn't like it had been before when he was taking the uppers and the sleeping pills. When he started experimenting with the, you know, the down stuff, that's when we started getting concerned, all of us, not just me. The down stuff is like Demerol and things like that, pain medication that brings you and lets you down and you kind of just float, you know. Dilaudid is like a synthetic and is five times more powerful than pure morphine, mostly given for cancer patients, terminally ill cancer that just couldn't handle the pain. But see, in his mind were not illegal drugs. These were prescription drugs. Now, the doctor's writing them for him. He's abusing them, but they're not illegal drugs in his mind.
I got a call from Elvis saying, Jerry, can you help me? And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, I'm on the floor. I can't get up. And I said, who's there? And he said, nobody. So I ran downstairs. I don't know what car I got into, whatever. Went to the doctor's house, and sure enough, Elvis was there. This was a proud man. And, you know, he was even proud around us. And this broke my heart. And he was on the floor. So we picked him up, put him in bed. His legs really just wasn't working. I was hurt, I was angry, and I waited downstairs for the doctor to come in. And I said, what the hell is going on? He said, what are you talking about? And I told him what I'd just gone through. And he said, well, you know, this liquid diet, and we're not giving him any drugs, we're just giving him placebos. And I threatened the doctor. I said, if I ever see this man in this shape again, I will go all the way. I go upstairs, and Elvis is on a stationary bicycle. Just, I mean, he's going full speed. She probably hadn't been out of the bed in 4 weeks, right? and Charlie doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know about my meeting with the doctor and everything. And damn it, Charlie, when you get your medical degree, you can start telling the doctors how to treat me. And he was furious.
Elvis took drugs because he liked them. There was no, everybody thinks that there's some sort of supercilious situation where he would develop this thing of trying to escape anything. He just fucking loved them. He loved drugs. I mean, I'm talking when he would sit and say, and I'd sit down and say, Elvis, you don't need to take all this shit. He said, I need it. When a person has that mentality, there is no way you can stop them. They're going to do it, and that's the end of it. It's like I said, I need a drink. You say, no, you don't. I need it. You can't. You're done.
None of the guys were in any doubt. The drugs and ensuing health problems had changed Elvis both mentally and physically. Elvis had not been in good health for some time, and many of his physical problems were caused by his diet. Elvis had eaten typical Southern cooking all his life, mostly fried and deep-fried and refried dishes, a diet certainly not conducive to good health.
He would eat crisp bacon, sliced tomatoes, mashed potatoes and gravy, and sauerkraut, believe it or not, and mix it all together and eat it and loved it. And Elvis would eat stuff till he got tired of it and then he wouldn't eat anymore. So he got off of it. The last year of Elvis's life, he went back to eating mashed potatoes, sauerkraut, sliced bacon, sliced tomatoes. I mean, bacon, sliced tomatoes, very crisp. And I said, you know what you're doing here? What do you mean? I said, you're back. It's the way you used to eat in 57. He said, I never thought about that.
Elvis had a lot of physical problems that were really eating away at him. He had glaucoma. He had hypertension. Do you know that every night after a show, his blood pressure would shoot up to 180, 200 every night? And that's a tremendous strain on the heart. Elvis had a spastic, twisted colon. I can't tell you the problems that plagued him because of it. He also had his blood sugar that was a little too high. His body would start to get bruises on his leg. One night we were on tour, he tripped and fell down the stairs at the back of the stage, twisted his ankle, and he had a very difficult time after that moving on stage.
Midnight, August the 15th, 1977. Waiting for the tour to commence, the guys knew Elvis was unhealthy, but they still believed nothing could touch or hurt him.
August 15, 1977, I flew in from Los Angeles getting ready to do a tour. That next day, we were supposed to leave for Portland, Maine. And we were sitting around the kitchen talking, and Elvis was upstairs with Ginger Alden's girlfriend at the time, and Billy Smith was there and his wife, and they leave. We just ate dinner, the guys, a couple guys sitting around talking about tomorrow, what we got to do. I call upstairs, and I said, Elvis, I'm here. Anything we need, anything I should know about, anything you need for tomorrow? And he was fine. He was seemed very well.
3 or 4 o'clock, I don't remember exactly what time it was, but he called out at the house and he said, you know, would you and Joe come out and me, you and Joe and Ginger go down to the racquetball? I said, sure. So we met there about somewhere around 4:30, I guess. And it was Joe and Ginger, and then Elvis and Ginger, and then me and Joe, and then me and Elvis. And then the time it got to me and Elvis, well, it done got down to silliness. It was no longer a racquetball game, even though we were getting exercise. We were trying desperately to see who can nail the other one with a ball, you know. And then he finally swung so hard he missed, and he hit himself on the shin. And that ended the game right there. He went complaining about it hurting. So I raised his pants leg up there, and I looked at it, and I said, it's not bleeding. I said, it can't be hurting. Then he got into a kind of a melancholy mood. You know, he went to the piano, and he was playing different songs for, you know, for Ginger and us. And then that lasted maybe, well, 15, 20 minutes.
Lost in his music, it was as if Elvis was 21 again.
Far away, I'm always longing for the day. My darling, you are home to stay. I'd be lost without your love.
And then we went back to Graceland. I went upstairs and I washed and dried his hair for him. And we talked in the bathroom. He even told me, he said, man, he said, you know, I'm going to try to make this the best tour ever, you know. And he said, I'm going to try to go to sleep. I said, okay. I said, you need me, I'll be at the house, you know. And I assumed he was going to bed. His moods swings were more frequent. Most of the... Elvis Presley was always an upbeat person. He really was. And I guess that's one of the things, boy, that made you, you know, like to be a part of that, because he was. And then to see him have these mood swings, you know, more frequent, and it was scary. You know, it really was. And I didn't like it. To be honest with you, I just didn't like it at all.
I would say that Elvis started slipping after he accomplished that feat of the 1.5 billion people watching him live from around the world on that satellite show. From that point on, I would say it was just a slowly slide. No up and down, just slowly slide.
I tried not to let his moods a lot of times affect my moods. If I did, we were both in the pits of hell at that time, literally. And so therefore, when I thought he was down, I was going to try to be up. And when he was up, I was automatically up. I mean, I was that in tune to him. But it was difficult. It was hard, you know. And you want to just say, God, man, you know, come on. It's not too late. You know, get a grip in your life, you know, and get away from the drugs, you know. Don't use them. You don't have to. And take a little time off. Nothing's that impressive. You don't owe anybody anything. If you get rid of me tomorrow, and I told him that, and I meant it from the bottom of my heart, if you get rid of all these guys, they will understand. And if they don't, they were not your friends to start with. But take some time off. And he'd just look at me and say, I can't. I owe too much to too many people.
We lived a wild and fast life in those matter of years that he was on earth. So like that song, you know, he did it his way. I'm not giving the song any credit, but I wish he would have changed and did it our way, but he did it his way. We could talk to him at times, he'd sit and agree. He'd say, yeah, I'm gonna change my life. Yeah, I'm not ready. I'll do it when I'm ready to do it. And we all had that hope, because the last vacation in March of 1977, we all went to Hawaii. We had a great time. He was in a great mood. He was out there on the beach having a good time. He's overweight at the time, but he was smiling. We thought, hey, this is a good chance. You know, he did clean his act up for about 30 days or more. But then all of a sudden, boom, right back again.
At Graceland, Elvis now faced the grind and rigors of yet more performances with the backup of his friends. None of them were happy. Elvis's decline had accelerated.
When I see him on stage performing in the manner that he started performing there at the end, where he wanted to do the best show he could, but with what he was...
Nothing left.
The where he was at, he was really burning, and the light was getting dimmer.
I must say, this is painful for me, that when Elvis came on stage, he gave such a the guy, whoever has not seen Elvis live has missed the greatest entertainer of the 20th century, the greatest star of the 20th century. But when I saw him, my heart sank because I knew that something was wrong. I could see it in his eyes, I saw it in his face. I said, he can't last like this another 5 years.
We were all very frustrated. Only thing we could do is that. He's 42 years old. You can't force this man to do anything. You know, people say, why did you guys have him committed? How could I have him committed? He's 42 years old. I can't have him committed. Even his father couldn't have him committed. You know, you can't prove he's crazy. Your hands are tied.
I didn't lay back in the later years. That last year and a half, I didn't lay back. I said what I wanted to say. The hell of it is, after all, I look back on it, it didn't do any good, you know, and that's what hurts more than anything.
6 a.m., the 16th of August, 1977. Elvis was restless. He told Ginger he was going to read in the bathroom. 2 p.m., the 16th of August, 1977. Ginger went to the bathroom to check if Elvis was okay.
Got out the next day, came to the house about 12 noon, this is the 16th, and about 2 o'clock, the phone rings, intercom, and one of the maids picks up the phone, and it's Ginger. She says, come upstairs, I need help. Elvis fainted. So I ran upstairs. I go into the bathroom, and Elvis had fell over. He was laying on the floor. I turned him over. And I knew he was dead. I just knew it. But I was hoping he wasn't. I picked up the phone, called the operator. They didn't have 911 at that time. And said, we need an ambulance here at Elvis Presley's house. And I didn't tell him who it was. And meanwhile, I couldn't do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation because Elvis' mouth was closed shut. There was no way possible. There's rumors I did that, but somebody made that story up. I was trying to massage his heart as well as I could, and it just seemed forever. People were all coming up there, and it was pandemonium. The ambulance finally showed up, and it seemed forever, and I found out later it was like 20 minutes before they got there. We got him into the ambulance. The stretcher came, got him down in the ambulance. I jumped in the back of the ambulance, all the way to the hospital. We're talking to him, and we get to the hospital real quick. The Baptist Hospital. Got there and they rushed him into the emergency room. I tell you, it was tough. And 30 minutes later, about 30 minutes, I would think, doctor came into the room and he said, Elvis has left. Elvis is gone. And we all broke down and we all hugged each other. And it was, very emotional time, naturally. We were, still in a state of shock, even when you think about it. We never thought this could ever happen.
I go to Graceland, I pull into the gates, and Elvis's uncle says to me, Larry, did you hear what just happened? I said, no, what happened? He said, Elvis just died. I said, well, wait a minute, what did you just say? He said, Elvis just died. I look up at Elvis' bedroom, and I looked at him. I can't begin to tell you the state of mind that put me in.
About 1:30, a quarter to two, the phone rang, and it was my cousin, Patsy, who is Elvis' double first cousin and my first cousin. So she had called out there, and she said, oh, my God, she said, Elvis is dead. And I said, whoa, wait a minute, Patsy. I said, what do you mean? I said, is he gone to the hospital? She said, yeah, they've taken him to the hospital. I said, he's been, you know, in the hospital before. I said, he'll be all right. She said, no. She said, he's dead.
There was a PR guy from the hospital was there with me. He asked me, he said, do you want to make the announcement that Elvis is no longer with us? And I couldn't do the announcement. I couldn't make the announcement. The press, I told the PR guys, you do it. I can't do it.
And, God, we're driving down, and the radio's on, and they play an Elvis record, and the disc jockey says, by the late Elvis Presley. Ugh. I literally went berserk. I realized I'd never see Elvis Presley again. And it's the first time I realized it. And I hit this wall so hard, I crushed my hand, I had to have an operation. Still has scars.
And Colonel was on the phone to Joe. And he was saying, yes, I know, and you need to do this, and you need to do that. So he hung up the phone, and I was leaning on the television set. It was on a stand. And I was leaning on it, my left arm, in fact. You know, things become really indelified in your mind. And he walked up within probably 8 inches of my face, 10 inches, and he said, you got to go back to Memphis. Elvis is dead. And I looked at him, and it hit me like a sledgehammer. And I looked at him, and I said, listen. I said, you know what? I said, you finally ran him to the ground, didn't you? And he got mad at me. I said, you know what I'm talking about. I said, y'all wouldn't let him up. You kept working him. He said, you need to leave. And I said, yeah, I'm going to leave to keep from knocking your damn teeth out.
When they brought him, you know, to the house and all the next day, I had some relief, you might say, when I saw him. Because I realized it's true, you know. You've got to accept it. It's true. Whereas before I could believe, you know, that he was just sick, you know, in the hospital. I was just hearing what they wanted to tell me. But when you see the real thing, then you know it's, you know, it's there. And you got to deal with it.
I got into the house, and there is a group. A lot of the guys are there, and there's little Lisa Marie walking around saying, my daddy is dead, my daddy is dead. Vernon, his father, is sitting in a chair. He said, Larry, Larry. And I run over to, and I collapse into his arms. What am I going to do? What am I going to do, Larry? He said, Larry, you're going to have to go do Elvis's hair. You got to go to the mortuary, Larry. You got to, you know, he knows, you know how he would like to look. I said, don't you worry, Mr. Presley. Don't you worry. I'll go.
And I would never, ever thought he would have died. We all talked about it, but he's too strong. He was too strong of a person, we said. He's going to change his life. And he didn't. It was tough. It got to a point where a lot of guys didn't want to talk about it.
I think that he had so much to give. And here it is, you know, he hits the floor and died by himself. And I think that's horrible. I think that, I mean, nobody has a, nobody, I mean, nobody wants, I mean, everybody's, nobody wants to die. And nobody wants to, especially die alone, I don't think. It would have been so nice if we all could have been around him. But, I mean, as it was, he fell forward on the floor and died. It's horrendous.
I was led by these police officers into a brick building that was very cold, very dark. It was a long corridor. I walked down this corridor, and all I could hear was my heart beating, thumping, boom, boom, boom. And I stopped in my tracks because I saw what was in the other room. There was a table. and saw a body on the table with a sheet. I walked into the room. There was Elvis. I walked up to him. I stood right by his head on this side. Charlie Hodge stood on the other side. There was a few morticians in the room. And there was a silence for a long period of time. I just looked at that face, that beautiful, magnificent face. Now I had to do his hair, and the next shock kicked in. We were off tour for 6 weeks. We had a hiatus period. There was a regrowth, half an inch, so. All white hair. I didn't bring my dyes with me. I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do now? There was a lady there, and I said, do you have your mascara with you? And she did. It was a little black, thank God, mascara. It was a little teeny brush. So I smeared it all around, blended it into his black hair that we dyed black, and it worked. It took me a good 45 minutes to an hour just to prepare his hair, because first of all, Elvis was lying horizontally. His life force left the body, so there was nothing there. So I had to work on it, work on it, work on it, which I did. At a certain point, the morticians who were applying makeup to his hands and his upper body like they do, they pulled the sheet down. And Charlie Hodge screamed. He said, what the hell are you? How could you do that in front of us? So the crisscrossed autopsy scars. They covered back up. And over the years, you know, the big story, Elvis might be alive. Oh, how I wish that was true. I worked on his body. And I've worked on his body thousands of times. It was Elvis Presley. That's it. There's no doubt about it. And memories just started cascading down. Memories of the first night that I met Elvis, telling me how I must have been plucked out of the millions and millions of lives to be Elvis. There has to be a reason. And things over the last 13, 14 years. It was so unbelievable, so surrealistic. At a certain point, I thought, no, wait a minute, this isn't real. He's sleeping. He's going to open his eyes. He's going to imitate Chief Inspector Clouseau from the Peter Sellers Pink Panther movies. Elvis knew all the lines. He was going to wake up and sit up and say, hey, what's going on? What the hell's going on here? Let's get back to Graceland. No. I understood exactly what was happening. I understood this is the corpse of Elvis Presley, and his life force, his soul, is not in that body anymore. Vernon Presley, Joe Esposito, and a few of the guys, Jerry Schilling and a few others, we walked up to see Elvis for the very last time, because now he's going to be interned. Someone took his TCB ring off, and the lid of the coffin is coming down, and I'll tell you right now, purposely, consciously, right before the lid came down, I put my hand in, and I put my hand right on his forehead and said goodbye. And I wanted to be the last person to touch him. The lid came down, and I was.
The funeral, during the funeral, some weird things happened, you know. We got ready to load the casket into the hearse after we loaded it and all of a sudden this tree limb broke and made a hell of a sound, really did, made a crashing sound. It was not that big a tree limb, but it was big enough. And to look at it, it looked green. It didn't look like it was rotted and fell. It looked, everybody kind of looked at each other, and of course I think Lamar said something, you know, said, well, he's still at work or something like that, you know. Then we got to the mausoleum, and they had him set up, and there was this little round window up above, and it faced east and west. And it was, I guess, around 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. And when the sun finally came over, where the wood separates the panes, there was four of them, it throwed this pretty across that casket you've ever seen. Of course, I can't tell you the cold chills that run across my body, you know, from the thought.
You know, my best friend is dead. No matter what you want to say, that's the biggest loss to me I've ever had. And we can say he had a good career, we can say this, we can say that, but the guy's dead.
It was that rocket ride with Elvis that we went through. It was such a part of life, you know, and a fascinating one at that. And you can't just turn that on and off when you get ready. There's times when it'll hit me and I'll just, sometimes it's happy, sometimes it's sad. And needless to say, a lot of times I've listened to an Elvis song and it just broke down, you know, and cried.
Oh, I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times, they are not forgotten. Look away. Dixieland.
There's not a day that goes by I don't think about him. I have dreams about him. I've had him, my last wife. One night I just jumped up in the bed, sitting straight up. Elvis said, "Holly, Lamar," and I heard him, and he woke me up. I mean, I heard his voice like he was right next to me, and I was in a cold sweat. She said, "What is it?" I said, "He just hollered at me," and I. It every day it goes on.
Early Lord, one frosty morn. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland.
I still get very pissed off about it. You know, it took a while. I didn't get pissed off right away. I was too hurt, too confused, too frustrated over not being able to do anything to stop it, and I get pissed off with the people that helped contribute to it. But I get pissed off at Elvis. He was a smart man, he knew what he was doing, but he denied it. Maybe he really couldn't see any way out of changing. He mentioned it to Billy, his cousin. Billy told me that last year when we weren't around. He mentioned to him that, you know, maybe he did sometimes take a little bit too much medication.
I was angry about his death. Elvis, I thought he had no right to die. I thought he had no right to die at that age. I think that he left too much on the table. If anybody ever left too much on the table, Elvis did.
Bound to die. But all my trials, Lord,
just flash back to all the good times we were having there. You know, all the parties up by the pool and smiling and laughing and having good times, but it's never going to happen again.
I spent about 20 years trying to make up for it after Elvis died, making up for all the things that I didn't do. With my family, when I was taking those pills and when I was with Elvis, I'm not very proud of those things. But that was the way of life we had. It was the mentality that Elvis really set, and of course we didn't have to go along with it, but we did, is that the life it belongs to the guys and not to wives. And he excluded the wives a lot in what we did, but that's really no excuse for me.
His truth is marching on.
The impact upon my life has been so profound. Not just meeting Elvis and working for him and having the unique relationship that I did have with him, but his death. You know, the day he died, and then I went to the mortuary to do his hair, I thought to myself then and there, I'll never be the same again. And I haven't been. It's almost like my soul ruptured, so to speak. Yes, you know, you come to terms with it, but it stays with you. And that moment, those moments of his death, have remained until this very moment, and I'm sure they will until I take my last breath.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. W.C. Handy, won't you look down over me? Yeah, I got a first class ticket, but I'm as blue as a boy can be. Then I'm walking in Memphis, just walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel? Saw the ghost of Elvis on Union Avenue. Followed him up to the gates of Graceland, and I watched him walk right through. Now security, they did not see him, they just hovered around his tomb. But there's a pretty little thing waiting for the king down in the jungle room. When I was walking in Memphis, I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel? They've got catfish on the table, they've got gospel in the air. River glad to see you when you haven't got a prayer. Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring. Touchdown in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the port.